You're listening to the Sketchnote Army Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Rohde, the author of the Sketchnote Handbook and the Sketchnote Workbook. And this is the podcast where I chat with sketchnoters and visual thinkers and try to understand what makes them tick.
Hey, are you looking for the ideal sketchbook for your sketchnoting practice? The Sketchnote Idea Book is the sketchbook designed for sketchnoters. Equipped with no bleed, no show-through paper, you can take almost any marker or pen you can throw at it. Get 10% off with code ARMY at airship.store.
Hey everyone, it's Mike and I'm here with Dan Rome, the Dan Rome, calling to us from his studio. You can see he's got whiteboards and he's got paintings. He's drinking tea, it looks like.
And absolutely.
So welcome to the show. Thanks for being here, Dan.
Mike, it is always a pleasure. You and I have been talking for a long time, and every time we get to, I enjoy it. So this is fabulous. Thanks for having me.
Same here. So our history is in 2016-ish, I recorded a podcast with you, and I lost it. Something happened with the audio, and that's bugging me for like forever. And so having Dan Rome on the show is like a huge get for me. So I feel really excited to have you here. Even though I've been on your sessions and stuff, and we've done stuff together. Like, it's always bugged me that I lost this, and we had a really good discussion, which I can't prove. So now we'll just do it again,
and we'll just take it into completely different way. And the other thing, Mike, just if I might, is just the fact the nature of our careers and our passion is so interwoven, if you will, that like we keep popping up. I just keep seeing you everywhere. It's like, hey, there's Mike. You know,
same thing with you.
Yeah, exactly. So it's a pleasure.
So one of the couple of things I wanted to talk about were your books, of course. I'm curious about your painting, but we always sort of start the show off with origin story. So I think we all know what you do, but you can start with what you do and then go right into like, how did you end up here? Like as a little kid, what drew you into this visual thinking stuff? I think we're both also user experience people. Yeah. So maybe that had some impact. I'm really curious about that trend. Like, how did you get here?
Wow. Well, that's a fantastic question, Mike, and what a great place to start. And the simple answer is I actually drew something out in anticipation of this.
Nice.
As a little kid, you know, there I am like everybody else. I'm looking at the world and it's awful confusing.
Yeah.
And people are telling you to do things and here's how to act and here's what to learn. And a lot of it was very confusing. And I've spent everything. This is the entire summary of what we're going to talk about. How can I figure out a way to go from that to that so that things are clear? So I was always, like every kid, I drew a lot. But like many kids, I never stopped the drawing part. So I've learned to draw badly, really, really well. and I'm sure that people who follow you probably have similar types of stories, like the visual thinking side, the visual storytelling side. Maybe can I have, you know, mom, dad, school teacher, maybe could I have a few less words and maybe a few more pictures? And so that's really the origin story. Nothing particularly unique there. But I would add one thing, Mike, if I could, because that kind of powered me up through university. But I had this kind of critical catalytic moment when I was at university, maybe my second year of school. So I was studying out here in California in Santa Cruz. And I thought that I wanted to be a doctor at that time. So I was on the pre-med track. So I was taking biology and lots of chemistry. And if anybody's ever taken, you know, organic chemistry back in the old days, pre-digital anything, you know, you'd build everything out with these models of molecules. Mm-hmm. And so organic chemistry was entirely visual. And as a model builder, which I've always been to, plastic models, airplane models, that kind of thing, the idea of trying to understand what the professors were teaching us about these fundamental concepts of how do atoms bond to create these molecules, and you can model it out because there are very specific rules of how each of these different types of atoms is going to bond with the other ones. So that was really cool. And so I'd be in chemistry class and learning that. And then I'd go over to painting class because I was also taking painting, and our professor would be talking about fundamentals of really good composition, and he'd be talking about the golden mean and the Fibonacci numbers, and you know, you don't have to paint that way, but if you look at the works of Leonardo or if you look at the works of Michelangelo, if you look at really, really outstanding, classic, beautiful artworks, the Parthenon, they seem to follow these kind of beautiful, harmonic, mathematical formula. And I thought, wait a minute. this is crazy. I'm over there in chemistry and they're teaching me like visually how things fit together so that they work. And now I'm over in art and they're teaching me ways to visually put things together so that they work. And it's like, these rules are the same. Mm-hmm. Isn't that amazing? And so I kind of created this path. Happily, as I mentioned, I went to the school called Santa Cruz, part of the UC system, down on the beach in California. Mm-hmm. And that's at Santa Cruz, even in the 80s, or especially in the 80s, it was a pretty funky school. And they were like, hey, make your own, design your own major. Mm. So I designed one that was an intersection between fine art and biology / chemistry, because I really found that, you know, an interest. And you can imagine my parents, I get a degree in painting and a degree in biology, and you're functionally unemployable. Like, what are you going to do with that? Other maybe than do scientific illustration, which yeah, was a potential true path. But I did not really have a talent at that, which is a side note as to why. And so what I did instead is I became a consultant. I had worked my way through school doing graphic design, like basic, okay, fundamental, pre-digital paste-up, like mm-hmm. X-Acto knives, wax machines, galleys of type on paper.
I've done that.
Like all that. So that was a skill that I had. So I was able to get a job with a newspaper in San Francisco.
Okay.
And I was working in the advertising department, like doing longhand analog advertising design. And I realized I was really interested when I would talk to the advertisers to custom build for them an ad, you know, for their furniture mm-hmm. store, for their car wash, or so for their dance party or for their theater production. Talking to the people who were buying the ad to find out, what is it that you're really doing? Like, what, that's cool. You know, what is your theater production? Or what, tell me about the strategy mm-hmm. behind your car wash. Like, how does that overlap? Because I really want to make an ad that's going to appeal to what you're trying to achieve. And long story short, Mike, that became really the career path, is talking to people who have an idea, asking them what they're trying to do, and then translate it using these visual skills. And, mm-hmm. you know, hey, basta, that's the story. So does that make sense?
Yeah, that totally makes sense. That's really interesting. You talk about this connection between painting and biology and, you know, debating if you should be a medical illustrator. So, I mean, what did your parents think when you went through this whole degree and then you're doing, you know, like layout at this newspaper? Like, were they bummed out? Obviously it's worked out pretty well, but what did they, and maybe the lesson I'm asking for is sometimes you make these decisions to go and do things that don't always make sense in the moment, but in the, if you see, have a vision for it, that it makes sense in the long term. And then the other thing that I was commenting to someone on Substack the other day, where they talked about, they did this weird job that if you thought about it, it would make no sense in your future career, but in the context of looking back, it totally made sense. And I have one of those experiences too. I was a wash rack kid at a car dealership. Yeah. So I got to negotiate with salespeople and learn who were the good guys and who were not the good guys and how to kind of do stuff. And that's really influenced my whole career. So now I'm like totally off on this question, but,
well, no, Mike, you're right. Yeah? It all, everything only makes sense when you look at it backwards. Mm-hmm. Like, how did any of us, and I'm talking about you, me, anybody who might be watching this or listening to this, anybody that you know, you ask someone, how did you get where you are? And everybody will say, well, it was a long and winding road, but I ended up here. And it all kind of makes sense when you look at it backwards.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting because just the other day, I have a friend who's a school teacher who teaches 10th grade, and he asked me to come online and we do a virtual session with his 10th graders. Mm-hmm. And we were and they had similar questions because, hey, you're a published author, you managed to have created a career of things that you seem to have been passionate about your whole life. Mm-hmm. How in the hell do you make that happen?
Yeah.
And, you know, the 10th graders, I'm like, kids, you know, I wish I could tell you, but the fact is you got to think between what is a kind of applicable, practical part of what you want to do, because you are going to have to eat. Like, that's
right.
True. There is an applied, practical element to life. You have to put Cheerios on the table every single day. And so in order to do that, you've got to make some money. So you have to have some practical side. But on the other side, let's not forget the aspirational side, because if you're just eating breakfast and you're not dreaming, why are you even living? So you've got to be able to do the practical and the aspirational. So you got to eat and you got to dream. And you're lucky as heck if by building upon the practical and loving your creative side, your dreaming side, you can weave them together into something that will get someone to pay you a dollar to do that. And kind of explaining it, And again, same thing, Mike, you're saying, is it only makes sense looking backwards. Mm-hmm. And I want to, something you were starting to ask me, how did my parents think about this sort of weird mishmash education? Well, they were delightful. They by that point, maybe it was a little bit of a different era, but by the time I left home and went to college, like, you're out of the house. You know, yeah. Parents are like, you've got agency now, you're self-propelled, Godspeed, good luck, we're here if you need us, but, you know, we're moving and not leaving the address behind. So they were just delighted by the fact that I was able to earn money doing graphic design.
Cool.
And then I'll tell you, though, and this is going to be relevant to where this conversation right now might take us. The really critical moment when I was working for that newspaper doing that advertising design, perhaps there were two. One was learning to ask people, I can draw you the picture, but to what end? To what purpose is your ad? If I know what you're trying to achieve, I can make a whole lot better creative advertisement. Mm-hmm. So one was learning to ask good questions and listen, then convert that into a visual or a story. The second one is just by virtue of luck, being in the right place at the right time. The newspaper I was working with was one of the first in San Francisco, which was kind of on the bleeding edge at that time, given proximity to Silicon Valley, to move to digital layout tools. So mm-hmm. this was in the late 1980s. And so at that newspaper, we got the first Macs, we had the first Adobe PageMaker, we had Freehand. These are tools that to folks today are the ancestors, the legacy what Adobe is now. Adobe barely even existed at that time. There were other companies.
Right.
So the trick there, why I think that's important, is not only are you learning to be creative and tell a visual story using tools, analog or traditional, but now you're meeting at this intersection of this arrival of new technology that is scary as heck and seems to put a lot of your skills out of work. Because if PageMaker is going to set up literally the page for me and run the right line length for my text and do the leading and suddenly gives me options for, you know, in the early days, 75 different fonts. Mm-hmm. Well, a week before, I was running that through a Linotype machine, and this is old, you know, old man telling stories that don't matter. But that was a trade. Like, you had to know how to spec things by eye, and now the computer's doing it for you. And it's like, well, should I? It's putting me out of work, but it is enabling me to focus on the parts of layout that were compelling anyway. Mm-hmm. So we're going to get to that, because this is where I think we're at another inflection point
right now. I think so, too. Yeah, it's a great discussion.
And if I might share one more story, this was learning, and it's going to be relevant for today, is I was working at a small scrappy newspaper here in San Francisco. And at that time, the San Francisco Chronicle was the big daily newspaper, mm-hmm. former Hearst newspaper, you know, William Randolph Hearst, all the stories, mm-hmm. Big money, long history. And it was really interesting. And I don't know how this is going to land with people, but we went over to visit the Chronicle production room, and they were a union shop. Mm. And it was really fascinating because we came in to say, these are some of the digital tools we're bringing to bear. And they were highly resistant because, looking at it, if we move to those digital tools, a lot of our journeyman production people are going to be out of work.
Yeah.
Well, I have no particular opinion about that. I know what I'm going to do. I'm not part of a union. I'm not part of a labor force to the degree that I know. But I'm going to go ahead and use these tools because they amp up what I do. And we're in a scrappy little shop. Da 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 da. And, you know, it's kind of interesting how that played out, because none of those people, if you didn't make the move to digital, you were out of a job.
Yeah.
Within a couple of years, it was done. And then a decade later, I found myself in New York working for a very fancy design firm right at the beginning of the internet boom, 1997, 1998. And I was working for a very famous former magazine designer who'd been smart enough, a guy named Roger Black. Who had been the designer of Time Magazine, Newsweek Magazine, Smart Magazine, Vanity Fair. I mean, he was the original art director for Rolling Stone Magazine under Jan Wenner back in the glory days for them of the 60s. Suffice it to say, Roger was very smart. He's like, there's this thing called the internet, and all these publications are coming to our design studio, and they're saying, can you help us make a website out of our magazine? And he's like, let's do that. So again, by the luck of being in the right place at the right time, technology revolution one, digital, or rather analog paced up to digital paced up, been there, learned a lot. Transition two, let's go from print media to online media And so we were there. We were designing, again, the original Time.com. We were doing IBM.com. We were doing the, we designed the original BarnesandNoble.com before even anybody knew what Amazon was. And again, forgive me for the old man stories, but it's relevant in the sense that, once again, how many of those magazine design people are even around 10 years later?
Yeah.
This is the nature of this beast that we have. And, you know, we're in another inflection point right now, which you can imagine where we might want to talk about. I'm going to stop there, but that's the origin story looking back. How does that land with you?
That sounds great. And we have so many parallels because I was fortunate. I was a student coming into the industry when that analog to digital transition happened. So I learned how to use a Haber rule. And you probably know what that is. This weird yellow plastic thing to measure typewriter type. So you could send, you could calculate it and send it to a typographer who would then send you the galley of type, which then I would wax and cut and lay out. So I immediately saw when the Mac started coming in, like, that was a huge leap forward in what was capable. And it favored me, again, being there at the right place at the right time. Same thing with the internet. Same story, shifting away from graphic design. So I feel those stories. And for a long time, I felt like, you know, the AI stuff that we see happening in a similar way presents us with a challenge and an opportunity. And the question again is, how do we as curious people that think visually adapt to this situation? So maybe
you
that's
said
a good
it
place
first.
To,
you yeah, said AI this. First, but let me tell you, I got a backside to this whiteboard, which I've already prepared. So that's where we're going to go. And it's going to get contentious as all heck, but why not?
Yeah.
I just came from a remarkable presentation last night. Again, I live in San Francisco, so I'm just across the bridge from Berkeley, and there is an organization at Berkeley in their computer science school called the Simons Institute for the Future of Computing. And every month they'll put on like a symposium about something that's related to, obviously, the fundamentals of computing. And last night they had three leaders, one from Google DeepMind, one from Anthropic, and one from not OpenAI, but was one of the founders of OpenAI. And they were talking about, why are we so surprised by the sudden arrival of AI? And where are we going to go next? And when are we going to hit AGI, you know, artificial general intelligence?
Right.
And it was a fascinating, fascinating conversation. We'll get there. But that is the technological transition that we're in right now that's going to impact every one of us that draws for a living or writes for a living. And it's a challenge and an opportunity, and we got to nuance that. So
yeah, it's definitely a mix. I mean, you know, just last week, we're recording this in April. We got the Studio Ghibli feature in ChatGPT where you can drop an image in and it'll turn it into a, I think it's, is it Miyazaki?
Miyazaki, absolutely.
It'll take that style, which, you know, I have real mixed feelings about it. Honestly, it's cool what it does. My son did a picture and sent it to me and he thought it was cool, and people are posting it. And at the same time, I feel really strange about someone scraping all of Studio Ghibli's stuff and turning it into just another filter in a tool, right? Like, it's like, it's sort of like both at the same time. I don't know how to describe that. It makes me uneasy and excited. How do you deal with that? I don't know. I don't know if I have the answer for that, but it is an interesting time that we find ourselves in.
We don't have the answers, but I've been spending, like you, a lot of time trying to form some opinions, and I have some. And they're always open to shift. But if we want to go there before this hour is up, I'd be delighted to flip this whiteboard over and talk it through. And in fact, well, you know, your show, there is a bit of a through line that I could throw out there. You'd said, let's talk about your books. So I did. It was a really good exercise for me because, like you, you write your books and then you move on. And it's interesting sometimes, I think, to go back and reflect on how did I write that one? What was it about? What did I learn? And how did that affect the next ones? And again, the same thing we're talking about, like these life stories.
Yeah.
In hindsight, there's a through line. At the time, there's not. But it's interesting. Yeah. I mapped them out, identified a through line, and I would love to share it with you if you think that's appropriate.
Yeah, I think we should do that, and then we can tie it to AI and sort of wrap up on the AI discussion and just sort of state where we're feeling, because I think, like you, I don't have any hard and fast opinions. And then I do have a couple, I guess. So it'll be interesting to see where we fall on that. And I'm totally open to being, you know, convinced of different ideas too.
So. Oh, well, let's be that. That's the way we have to be. Yeah. Well, you remember what F. Scott Fitzgerald said of you know, Great Gatsby fame. He said the sign of a good intelligence is someone who's able to keep two competing ideas in mind at the same time and not lose their shit. That's a paraphrase, but that's close to what he said. So let's hope we're all intelligent enough to keep the two. You know, life is a balance.
Yeah, it is, definitely.
And let's try to keep both sides moving. Yeah.
Yes. So start with back of the napkin. That's the one that I was introduced to, and it blew my mind. I was like, wow, people are writing books about visual thinking. I was just starting to get into it. I'd met Dave Gray. I went to one of his events, and it was starting to like form in my mind, and I've been doing, like, I look backwards, and I was doing it in college and doing it in my work, but I didn't know what to call it. And so when your book came out, it was like, wow, okay, this is cool. So let's start there and then work your way through the books and how they tie together.
Mike, let's do it. Okay, so on the whiteboard, here we go. Let's grab a red pen. We'll do through this really, really quick. And again, this was a useful exercise for me just before this call. I went and mapped things out. So back in 2004, I thought, let's write a book about thinking with pictures because nobody else had done it that I could find. Mm-hmm. So it took 4 years for that to happen. So that book finally came out in 2008. And that was number one, and it did really well. And I was more surprised than anyone. My publisher was surprised too. It sold a million copies. It's in 27 languages.
Wow,
it was
that's awesome.
That literally allowed me to quit my day job because I was still working for an agency at the time. We won't name any names, but I had gotten to the point where I hated it. And this was the thing that enabled me to say, I'm going to go out and do my own thing. So that was the genesis of it. And the idea was, how do I kind of codify the tools that I've developed on my own to try to take this complexity and make things clear by drawing it out? So there was a lot of cognitive science. There was a lot of triangulation with what was going on in people who were studying how does the human visual mind work. And then the outcome was the sort of the key to the back of the napkin is there's a formula at a macro level for neuromechanically how the human vision system processes the world. And when you understand that, you can hijack it. So the idea of the back of the napkin was if you seek to deconstruct something really, really complicated with your visual mind, here is a formula that you can do. Use that. That was the big breakthrough. And then the second book was, well, what about words? So I wrote a book called Blah, Blah, Blah. It took me 2 years to get out that. And it was really about combining the pictures and the words. So here's, I've got the pictures and the words. And I came up with something I called vivid thinking, which is really verbal plus visual, move them together into one notion. So let's be vivid. Let's use both our words and our pictures. And then I was doing a lot of public speaking and people were saying, well, how do I present effectively using those words and pictures? So that was the book Show and Tell. And then the publisher was really happy because the books were selling and they said, hey, it's time for you to do a greatest hits album. So I came up with a book called Draw to Win. This, I think, was about 2016. And what this is it's a series of maybe 12 very simple, very fast lessons on just how to really quickly use your visual mind to solve things, sell things, teach things, understand things. A lot of the same principles that you talk about in sketchnoting, a lot of the same things. And then I started to become really enamored of the work of Joseph Campbell, and you and I were talking about Star Wars there and the whole the hero's journey, like the classic story. So I said, well, wait a minute. We've got these pictures. We've got these words. We've got this ability to present. We've got all these skills now. Wouldn't it be awesome if we could figure out how to make a very persuasive slide deck that's just 10 slides long? Because if you really break the hero's journey down, you can break it down meaningfully into 10 very discrete beats. You know, and for those who are not familiar with what we're talking about, the hero's journey is exactly the storyline that George Lucas used line for line when he created Star Wars number one. And he had discovered it from a guy named Joseph Campbell, who passed away several years ago. But Joseph Campbell lived through almost, you know, from 1910 to 1990, something like that, and traveled all over the world and was a collector of great stories from all the myths and all of the great stories from cultures around the world that had withstood the test of time, whether it was the, like, Indian Upanishads or whether it was stories from the Old Testament or whether it was great myths from Southeast Asia, what have you. And he realized that these stories that stand the test of time and get told over and over and over and become these cultural touchstones for humanity all follow a virtually identical storyline. and it moves along these beats. And so what I did is I wrote a book called The Pop-Up Pitch. This is 3 years ago now, that really took everything and put it into a kind of a formula of saying, look, if you want to create a pitch in a PowerPoint deck or Google Slides or on a whiteboard, and you're trying to share an idea with someone with the idea of convincing them, or, well, more persuading them, gently persuading them to at least understand your perspective and perhaps to take action, the building of the slide order has already been done. This problem has already been solved. And so I just codified it. So that's the through line. Does that
Yeah, that's pretty cool. I love the way it sort of builds. So you see it starting with these componentry, and over time it's building up into, eventually you're getting to the point of like, how do you use all these skills to then convince people or get people to open their minds to a different idea or an idea that maybe they didn't consider and move them forward into that direction?
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
Pretty cool.
Yeah. Well, and again, it's like where we started, Mike. It's like this all makes logical sense now.
Yeah.
But that's only, again, looking back, is right. You can kind of see, oh, that came from that, which came from that. There was nothing that said, here, let's start in order to achieve that. That no, it didn't work that way. And I don't often think that it does. Our life is always a meandering journey, and it has a direction. You know, the direction is always back to this original one. This makes me uncomfortable. This gives me some comfort, and I'd rather be comfortable than not. And it, just expanding sort of the scope of that processing of complexity and confusion to understand it, to clarify it, and then to be able to share it with someone else so that hopefully you then pass the baton on to them and they can do the same thing. So that's up till now. With your permission, it ain't over. I'd like to flop the board.
Go for it.
Here we go.
Let's do it.
Hey, have you ever wanted to create travel sketch notes from an experience you've had just using the photos and memories you've got? In the Reflective Travel Workshop video replay, I'll guide you through my process for creating travel sketch notes and then help you reflect on your own photos and memories so that you can make travel sketch notes of your own trips too. This 2-hour recorded video includes a set of downloadable, printable sketching templates and process to kickstart your own travel sketchnoting practice. All this for just $20. Visit roadiesign.com/travel to purchase your video and templates today.
Go for it.
Here we go.
Let's do it.
Drum roll. Okay. So let me tell you for a moment about the consulting work, because all those books lead to three types of businesses that I do. For anybody who wants to pursue this path, and how do you make money doing this? Well, number one is if you have an opportunity to do work for a client, we'll call that what I would call the consulting side of the work. Someone pays you by the hour or by the project to use your tool sets or your talents or your skills to help them solve a problem. Cool. So I make money doing the consulting side. Then the second thing is, if you're paying attention to what you're doing as you do that, you might have a couple of interesting ideas which could become a book. So you could write a book. Now, whether that's published traditionally or self-published or a series of blogs or posts on LinkedIn, they're all cool. But the idea is you're creating content, you're creating a book, a corpus of knowledge based on the things that you've learned from your consulting work. That's cool. And once that's out there, you get recognized as a bit of a thought leader, hopefully, and then people will ask you to come in and talk to them or train them for making money. So now you've got three ways to make money. You do the work, you write about the work, and then you get to talk about what you wrote about. And the beauty of those is they then are also a self-fulfilling cycle, because then you're out there in front of people talking about the book, about the work, and someone says, can I hire you to do some more work?
Yeah,
and on you go. So over the last 10 years, the consulting work, I started to map this out. I have been blessed with the opportunity to do a fair amount of consulting work with people in cloud computing, companies like Snowflake. I've been doing a lot of work with Snowflake, so they're a ginormous multi-billion dollar cloud computing company. Cybersecurity, so companies like Mimecast and Proofpoint and some of those, companies that provide cyber protection for all of the data and whatnot. So I've been doing consulting work with them. I live in the Silicon Valley, so I've been doing technology-focused work forever. And these are both tech companies, as you can mm-hmm. imagine. Work with Microsoft, work with Google. All of those are focused on innovation, you know, a real thing. And then over the last 2 years, interestingly enough, I got a consulting gig to work with an electricity company.
Interesting.
Yeah. So I never expected that to happen. So a consultancy that's here in California that works primarily with our three big utilities in California. So PG&E, Southern California Edison, and San Diego Gas and Electric. So if you think about it, I think California by itself is like the world's fifth largest economy, just wow. the state of California. And those three utilities are together far and away collectively the largest electric and gas utilities in the country. And what's been interesting is to have a chance to work with them. Hmm. And I didn't know anything about the electricity industry, but I sure as heck do now. And it's yeah. fascinating because, Mike, every single thing comes down to power.
Yes.
Everything comes to power. It's amazing. Without energy, and specifically for the way we live, without electricity, nothing else happens. Like right. you talk about Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Like baseline, you got to power this stuff. Mm-hmm. And I was unaware of how it works. How is it monetized? How is it evolving? And the fact that electricity, while theoretically infinite, which it is, the sun is an infinite power source for us, an mm-hmm. infinite giant thermonuclear reactor that's right there in front of us, not 24/7, you know, 12 and maybe 5, if you will. Mm-hmm. It's not always visible to us, but suffice it to say, we are surrounded by energy, and yet using it, finding a way to generate it, store it, transmit it, more often than not becomes as contentious as anything else in human life. So it's fascinating, and mm-hmm. I don't want to wax too poetic about it, but suffice it to say, cloud needs more of that.
Yeah,
cyber
definitely.
Needs more of that. All tech needs more of that.
Yep.
And along the way, I still continue to work with a lot of different businesses, and I continue to work in the realm of creativity. Now, if you were to look at an intersection of all of these, are you ready for the unveil?
Go for it.
There she is, ladies and gentlemen.
Right in the middle.
Right in the middle. This is it. This is the revolution of the day. And AI, in particularly generative AI, which is the one that mm-hmm. has the ability that, you know, large language models, diffusion models, have completely captivated my interest. Completely captivated my interest. The good and the bad, the challenges, the opportunities. Like you said, your son getting to use, ChatGPT's new diffusion model to generate mm-hmm. Studio Ghibli style drawings from a stick figure drawing. Well, good for him and tricky. So that's where I'm putting my attention.
Mm-hmm.
I'm digging deep into, specifically I'm interested in the image generation AI. So mm-hmm. tools like you were talking about, we can dive into all kinds of detail. And I do have some opinions about sort of the ethical side of it, which may or may not be of interest to anyone. But for me, here it comes, my friends. Sometime within the next year to two, expect a new book called The Back of the Napkin 2.0, Solving Problems and Selling Ideas with the Robot. So the robot is here. And earlier I'd mentioned those, you know, the production teams at the newspaper who didn't want to upgrade. My perspective is that if we are in the creative industry, we have to. We have to learn how that thing works.
Yeah.
We have to learn. It is a tool set. That's what it is. Maybe it's paradigm shifting. Maybe not. I don't know. We hit paradigm shifting technologies all the time. This is a big one, and it was pretty fascinating being with that panel last night over at Berkeley where they were talking about when does AI become sentient, if you will. And lots of debate. One of the guys said not for 20 years. One of the guys said never, and the woman on the panel said, I think it's going to take place within the next 12 months. So, and these are the experts. So, fascinating stuff. I would love to talk about it more, but that's where I'm going. How does all the stuff you saw on the other side of the board, how do I use my visual mind to declutter a complex world? how do I use my visual mind in concert with my words and my verbal mind to understand what I'm talking about and convey it to someone else? How do I do that beautifully, effectively, efficiently, thoughtfully? All of that's going to change with this, and I want to try to figure that out.
Mm. Yeah, that's a big question.
Part
of me thinks a little bit about both using these tools, but also remembering that the way we operate is still, it still requires people to do some of it. Or maybe it's like going back to the transition from, say, analog to digital and then into internet. Let's go back to the one that's more analog to digital. Like, I was there for that. I was a student, so I was more on the digital side because I didn't have any old habits necessarily to unlearn. I was pretty new to it. I could do all those things. The beginning of my job began that way. But ultimately, I could see the benefits, and my dad had computers to get us ready for the computer revolution. So when the time came, not only was I an art director, but I was a system manager, and I managed the network and ran the backup tapes, and like, I was into it. Like, I've always had sort of this blend of the two. So on the one hand, I'm excited about the capabilities, and I've certainly used the tools. And on the other hand, my concern is how we use them, how we fit them in, so that we don't lose the thing that makes us unique. So in other words, if I'm just, rather than sketching and thinking, if I'm just asking the tool to generate it for me, like, where does that line cross, and where is the machine doing the work that maybe I should be doing? And then the other thing that I've seen being in technology is knowing that you can become dependent on the way a thing works. And we know that technology never stays the same. So what happens when that thing changes? If you've offloaded too much of your agency to the system and you can't do it on your own, like the power goes out or something like that, like, what do you do? I remember, and the last thing I'll say is, so in this time period when the new technology came on, I was in a small design firm, system manager, designer. When the power would go out in the area we were in, because it was growing, everybody would just be sitting around with twiddling their thumbs because Quark Express and their Macs were off. Yep. Nobody could work. And, you know, not to brag or anything, but I had been trained in the old way. So I just got sheets of printer paper out and started sketching and kept moving and had stuff. By the time the power came up, I was ready to go, and I just brought it into the machine. So I always thought of the machine as a tool. And I think maybe that's what I'm kind of getting at, is how do you remember that it's a tool and not give away too much of your skill to the machine, or selectively give it to the machine when it makes sense. Maybe that's kind of where I'm sort of sitting. Not even talking about any of the ethical things about, you know, learning, which I think probably could be a whole nother podcast. And maybe it doesn't make sense for us. It's kind of a foregone conclusion probably at this point. So anyway.
How are we doing on time, Mike? Because I've got a little model that I think I could draw out that's evolving in my mind. I've been putting a lot of cycles into this, and I'd love to share a little bit of a thought exercise. It's going to take maybe 5 minutes. Are we good for that?
Yeah, let's do it. Yeah, let's do
all
5 minutes.
So let me just kind of map out here, starting from some basic principles and some data, how I think a story starts to emerge that could be interesting, not to answer those really good questions you had, but just a way of thinking about them. So I just want to start with some research that I've seen lately that says that one third, and this is research that's been conducted for people who are interested. Adobe every year does a creativity survey, and they go and talk to thousands of business people across the United States and I think around the world, and they ask them things about creativity. So it turns out the Sharpie and Papermate, the company that owned them. Interesting. They also do a creativity study. McKinsey does a creativity study. So I've gone through them, and one piece of data that emerges, which I think is quite fascinating, is one third of adults think that they're as creative as they could be. So one third of adults think are as creative as they like to be.
Kind of satisfied where they're at, or
yep, which means that two thirds have said I want to be more creative than I am. Only one third are saying I'm as creative as I'd like to be, and I'm given the opportunities at work and at life to be creative. Two thirds of adults most want to be remembered for their creativity.
Mm.
Like, when you die, what do you want to be remembered for? I want to be remembered, my legacy to be my creativity. What did I put back out into the world? What did I write? What did I paint? What did I share? So we've already got a creativity disconnect. So something's up. But here's the truth, is there is a way to span this, and that is AI generative tools. Now, there are lots of ways. There's 1,000 ways for people to expand their creativity. There's 1,000 ways for people to meet this. But one of the ways that is true, especially for people who struggle with their creativity, I don't know how to be creative. I'd like to be, but I don't know how. I don't know how to draw. All the things that we've heard for forever. Generative AI tools actually offer a solution because they are a relatively straightforward. Assuming you have enough money to have a computer and an internet connection and you can pay, you know, individually, I'm going to just say AI generative tools represent a solution to empower creativity. Mm-hmm. But to your point, there's a big downside. Number one, they steal. They steal other people's work. They scrape the whole internet and they use that as the models from which they're going to feed you. It is awful that there is now a way to turn anything into Hayao Miyazaki style, because he, of all people, who has thrown away all technology, get it out. He is the one animation studio on earth that still does everything longhand, but they steal. The second thing they do is they generate an incredible amount of crap.
I think I've heard Slap used as a...
Oh my God, just awful, awful stuff. Number three is they displace people. And number four, they burn a tremendous amount of electricity. So there's probably other downsides. But here's the thing about creativity. So all of these by themselves, AI steals, AI generates crap, AI displaces people, and AI consumes a lot of electricity, is non-sustainable. All right. So here's the way creativity works. Creativity thrives against constraint. If I say, I need you to get to the moon, and here's $1,000, you're going to be a lot more creative in your thinking than if I say, get to the moon, and there's an infinite amount of money. Okay, creativity thrives under constraint. So let's just say that these are our constraints. So how do we reframe every one of these constraints into a positive? Well, you know Austin Kleon, our good friend Austin Kleon. How? Steal like an artist. Steal with honor. There are good ways to steal, and there are bad ways to steal. So if you're going to steal, do it well. How? Acknowledge your sources. Be open. Steal primarily from yourself. Be thoughtful. Acknowledge where things come from. Read Austin's book, Steal Like an Artist. Picasso was the one who said it. Steal like an artist. Steal with honor, and amazing things are going to happen to your creativity. So what you've done is you've taken a negative and turned it into a positive. All right, if it generates crap, well, how are we going to do that? Let's be let's be very, very thoughtful. Let's not generate crap. Let's make things that matter. So let's be very thoughtful about what we create. Don't accept that it's shit. You know, I don't need another AI-generated image of dogs playing poker that looks in the style of Van Gogh. I mean, look, the fact is that's going to burn itself out very fast. If you look at the home screens from most of the visual AI tools, the excitement, we get over it really fast, and we get overloaded and begin...
Pretty faddish, right?
So be thoughtful. Displace people? Okay, the only answer I can give to that is become irreplaceable. Become one of the people that can't be replaced. And how do you do that? Because you figure out how to take advantage of this thing. And then the third one, and this is a stretch, and this is what I've learned about the electricity piece. This is absolutely fascinating. And at the risk of like over pontificating, the trick with electricity is that for the most part, it can't be stored. I never knew that. Yes, there are batteries, but they are highly inefficient. They're incredibly expensive, and they don't even come close to 1% of what any functioning society needs. The trick with electricity is that it has to be consumed as it's being generated. You can't store that stuff. You have to figure out a way to consume it. And here's an amazing thing. Every time, I never knew this until I started working with PG&E, the Northern California Electric Utility. Every time I plug this in, every time I turn on a light, every time I turn on my water heater, somewhere in the world, a turbine spins up to generate electricity in real time to account for the action I just took. The fact that it works at all is a miracle. You know, there's a lot of downside. California, we've been having a lot of fires that have been, you know, most likely in some cases completely likely generated by poor electric infrastructure or poorly maintained electric infrastructure. There's a lot of downsides. Pacific Palisades fire, we're going to see how that came out, Northern California fires. Anyway, the idea is this. They're with me because it's going to be a stretch. One of the ways to store electricity is you can store it in a battery. Another way, and let's say that's a battery, is that you can actually convert the electricity into data, store the data, which doesn't require electricity to be stored, store it somewhere, and let's assume that that data is valuable, that that insight or data or information has value. Later on, you pay money for that data and you reconvert it back to electricity. Now, this assumes that electricity is abundant and it will be abundant again. Safely? We don't know. But there's a really interesting notion here that says, if you're going to burn electricity, what possible use could be ever better than being able to use it to realize your dreams? So the idea is, if you're going to be a burn electricity for AI, be thoughtful. Recognize that every time you put in a prompt or draw a picture, you're burning electricity. Mm-hmm. But if you are generating something of value, you're actually converting electricity into storable value. It's a stretch, but I want to work on that because there's something there. If you're creating valuable work that someone else is going to look at your AI generated images or texts or ideas later, and they will be valuable enough down the line for that person to say, or that robot to say, that's valuable, you're actually going to be retaining the energy in the form of data. Anyway, that's my pitch. I don't know how that lands, but that's where I'm going.
It's funny when you talk about the last one, I think about, the poster behind me, Back to the Future. He says, you made a time machine out of a DeLorean. He said, well, if you're going to make a time machine, you might as well do it with style.
You might as well. So. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So I don't know. I think if to me,
interesting,
I want to learn how to steal with honor. I want to learn how to be thoughtful about the things I produce. Yeah. I want to become irreplaceable. And I want to be able to dream big and understand that my dreams are burning electricity. But what else would I do with that electricity that's more valuable than dreaming big? Not me, everybody. Why not?
Yeah.
So anyway, that's where I am on it.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, you know, like I said, I don't have a hard, fast thing. I'm sort of torn in between. And I think maybe a lot of people are in the same place. Or maybe they're now coming to that. Like, if they start digging into it, like, well, there's some problems here, but there's some promise here. And I just keep going back to both these transitions you talked about, and there were a lot of boogeymen, you know, the old timers had a lot of boogeymen around these technologies. And I just looked at them logically and said that doesn't totally make sense because we're eliminating the part that takes the most time in design, the laying out the boards. I mean, I used to draw boards out with my rotring pens and blue line pencils and, you know, it was tons of work, right? I mean, I could do it. But when we switched over to, I think we were at Quark Express, you know, that took that whole process out of the loop. And I was now focusing on, well, what kind of interesting layouts can we do? I think you think about like David Carson, another Californian, like some of the crazy stuff he did. And he came from not a design background. He did some really crazy design stuff that probably pushed people in other places to go in different directions than they might have. Like, where would we be if, I mean, I don't know what he would have done if there was no technology. Maybe he would have found a different way to do it, but he's a pretty resourceful guy. So, yeah, I just think there's an opportunity to do something with it. And then the question is, what do we do with it? And how do we do it in the way you're talking about, in a thoughtful, honoring way that makes what we're doing useful for other people that we're working with or we're serving, right?
Yeah. Hey, Mike, can I give it one more? Are we out of time or do we got 30 seconds more?
Yeah, we got 30 seconds.
So I've been thinking this through, and I want to like make another thought model illustration for those of us who are maybe struggling with how do we deal with this revolution that is coming about because of AI. And the fact that the AI revolution is contemporary to other revolutions that are taking place around us is just notable. We're at a very interesting inflection point. You know, it's funny because just the age I grew up and you as well, and you know, there was this kind of notion like back in the 1990s, the Cold War is over, the Berlin Wall is done, history is over, it's all easy from here on. Well, guess what?
Yeah.
History ain't over. History comes back with a vengeance, and history is looking at us right in the face right now and saying things are upside down. Like there's a lot of revolutions going on right now, and one of them happens to be AI. The fact that they're all coming at the same time is quite fascinating. I mean, academically fascinating, May you live in interesting times. We sure do. But to give myself a little bit of solace, to give myself a little bit of calm, I think through the following thing. Imagine this. Imagine music. Are you a music person?
Oh, yeah.
I see it. Looks like a turntable back there you've got. Yep. You've got some vinyl.
Yep.
Okay, so think about this. That's a perfect example. In the world, in the entire history of humanity, up until about 1890, so roughly 130 years ago, the only way any human could ever hear music was to have it played live. Mm-hmm. Either you played it yourself or you hired a band. Or if you were really rich, you hired a court composer, a Mozart or a Bach or a Beethoven. And then if they wanted to perform their music, they would, you know, build a big concert hall and people would come and hear it. Because there was no way to record that music. None. The gramophone is invented. Imagine the moment. Prior to 1890, entire conservatories, universities, cultures, industries were created around the creation of live music. Mm-hmm. Because everybody loves music. There was no radio. There were no iPads. There were no earbuds. Nothing. And think about the revolution that represented. If you had dedicated your life to studying harp, because you were in demand, because at every wedding someone need a harpist, mm-hmm. and they're going to pay you. And now it can be recorded. Holy smoke. I'm at my next wedding, and I have a gramophone vinyl recording of a harp. I put that on. How many harpists have I just put out of work?
Yeah.
All of them except the one who was recorded. But here's the deal, why I can find some sort of comfort in this. Music isn't over. We actually now, after these multiple music revolutions of technology, have more music, mm-hmm. more availability, and I think the same thing's going to happen. It's a scary inflection moment, but it ain't going to kill us.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, live music is now coming back with a vengeance in a lot of ways because digital music is normal.
Right? Exactly. And now with the sheer amount of crap that gets generated, even in these early generations of image generation AI, actual paintings become even more valuable.
Yes.
Not less.
Yeah.
I've got a painting show coming up here in San Francisco starting on May 1st. Live paintings, can't wait to do it. I love to paint in large part as a remember your roots. Mm-hmm. And if you're going to steal honorably, even if it's from yourself. So what I've done is I've digitized all my paintings. I've fed them in to my own diffusion model, which is the type of model that an AI engine does. And now I'm trying to teach the robot to paint like I do.
Like you. Like a student.
Not to replace me. But because it's friggin' cool, and I can feed in ideas and see what it does, it's like I never would have thought of that.
Yeah, it's crazy.
I've got a sidekick now. It's awesome, which I never had before. So there's a lot there. Thanks for letting me share so much, Mike. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, this has been great. Thanks, Dan. Is the best place to go find you is danrome.com, I'm guessing?
Yeah, absolutely. So just good old danrome.com.
Okay.
Instagram is dan.rome.
Okay.
And then LinkedIn, of course. And I'm going to start posting all of this. It's going to go up on LinkedIn as I ramp up to working on the next book. You know how it is.
Yep.
You got to feed the beast. So.
Well, thanks so much for being on the show and talking about this. We didn't plan this, but it turned out really great. So I'm really happy you're on to talk this way. So thanks so much.
Well, you're a great interviewer, Mike. And I really appreciate you giving myself and other people you're talking to the time to, you know, let us go off on our weird tangents. I appreciate that.
That's my job.
And you're good at it. You're very good at it.
Well, thanks, Dan. You have a great day, and we'll talk to you soon. For everyone listening or watching, it's another episode. Talk to you soon.
The Sketchnote Army podcast was created by me, Mike Rohde, and brought to you by Rohdesign Studios. It's produced and edited by Alec Polianis of Amp Creative Studios. The theme music was created by John Schiedemeyer. To support the creation of this show, I invite you to buy one of my books, the Sketchnote Handbook or the Sketchnote Workbook. You can find the books on Amazon or go to peachpit.com and use the code ROADY40 for 40% off. Please share this podcast with other visual thinking friends and be sure to leave a nice rating on iTunes or your favorite podcast listening app so others can find the show.